Many years ago, I read a spiritual classic called The Doctor at Calvary. Some of you may have heard of it. It was written by a Catholic French physician who devoted his life to a study of the sufferings of Jesus from a medical and physiological perspective, not from a moral or psychological perspective, which is, of course, another important dimension. Once you read what he wrote, you will never forget it. I will present to you now, it's a whole book, I'll present to you a ruthless summary of the comments he makes on the sufferings of Jesus. And being in an agony, he prayed the longer, and his sweat became as drops of blood trickling down upon the ground. From the Gospel of Luke, the 22nd chapter. Let us remember that the only evangelist to record this fact was a physician. And our venerated colleague, Luke, whom Paul calls the beloved physician, does so with the precision and conciseness of a good clinician. The sweating of blood is a very rare phenomenon, but it is well described in the medical literature. It is produced, as Dr. Lebeck has written, in very special conditions. Great physical debility accompanied by violence, mental disturbance followed on profound emotion or great fear. Dread and horror are here in the maximum. There is an intense expansion of the capillaries beneath the skin, which burst on contact with the millions of sweat glands. The blood mingles with the sweat, and it is this mixture which forms into beads and flows over the whole body. Note that this microscopic hemorrhage is produced all over the skin, which thus suffers a great increase in sensitivity and becomes sore and tender while awaiting the blows to come. John records in chapter 19 that we just read, then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers of the guard take Jesus into the hall of the Praetorium. They prepare him for flogging by removing his clothes and binding him naked to a column. The arms are held up in the air, and the wrists are bound to the shaft. The scourging is done with numerous thongs to which are fixed two balls of lead or small pieces of bone. The number of strokes is limited to 39 by Hebrew law. But his executioners are Roman legionnaires, not limited to this restraint. And they will go on to the point of making him faint. There are two executioners, one on each side of him, of unequal heights. All this may be deduced from the directions on the marks of the shroud. They alternate their strokes with great zest. At first, the strokes leave long, livid marks, long blue bruises beneath the skin. Remember that the skin has already been greatly sensitized by the sweating of blood. The balls of lead make further marks. Blood pours out. Shreds of skin become detached and hang down. The whole of the back is now no more than a red surface. This great fool claims to be a king, quick, a robe, a scepter, an old cloak thrown over his naked shoulders confers on him the royal purple. A reed is in his right hand, and everything is complete except for the crown. They find thorn branches in the courtyard, and the branches are covered with thorns that are very long and very sharp and very hard. They have to be careful in planting the crown that they do not stick themselves. They carefully put the crown on his head and use rods to beat down the edges, to bind it on the head from the nape of the neck to his forehead. The thorns dig into the scalp and it bleeds. We surgeons know how much a scalp can bleed. The top of the head is already clotted with blood. Long streams of blood have flown down to the forehead and have soaked into the tangled hair and into the beard. I can see from the shroud a blow from a stick delivered from the side that has made a horrible bruise on his face, and that his fine, well-shaped nose has been disfigured by a broken septum. Afterwards, they tear the cloak from him, which has already stuck to his wounds. The blood starts to flow once more. He gives a great shudder. They replace his own clothes, which quickly become stained with red. The cross is ready. They place it on his shoulders. It is, in fact, not the whole cross, but only the great horizontal beam, which he must carry as far as Golgotha. But it still weighs nearly 125 pounds. The vertical stake is already planted at Calvary. And so he starts his journey with bare feet along the rough road filled with stones. The road is fortunately not very long, a little more than one-third of a mile. He often falls to his knees, and his knees are soon all raw. And all the time there is that beam balanced on his shoulders, bruising him, and which seems to wish to force its way into his back. His shoulders are covered with raw places, which open up again and again and get larger and deeper with each step he takes. There is at last the slope of Golgotha to climb. Jesus sinks to the ground, and the crucifixion begins. First of all, he must be stripped. The lower garments are dealt with easily enough, but the coat has firmly stuck to his wounds. That is to say, his whole body. And this stripping is a horrible business. Have you yourself ever been through this ordeal? Cloth ripping off scabs. This sometimes requires a general anesthetic. Each thread has stuck to the raw surface, and when it is removed, it tears away one of the innumerable nerve ends that have been laid bare by the wound. These thousands of painful shocks add up and multiply, each one increasing the sensitivity of the nervous system. Now, it is not just a question of a localized area, but of almost the whole surface of his body, and especially of that dreadful back. And they lay him down on his back. An assistant holds out one of the arms with the palm uppermost. One single blow with a great hammer, and the nail is already fixed in the wood, in which a few vigorous taps fix it firmly. Jesus has not cried out, but his face has contracted in a terrible way to see. His thumb, with a violent gesture, is striking against the palm of his hand. The median nerve has been touched. An inexpressible pain darts like lightning through his fingers, and then like a trail of fire right up his shoulder and bursts into his brain. Wounding the great nerve centers causes the most unbearable pain that a man can experience. It nearly always causes a fainting fit, and it is fortunate when it does. But Jesus is not willed that he should lose consciousness. The raw places on the nervous center remain in contact with the nail, and later on, when the body sags, it will be stretched against this like a violin string against the bridge, and it will vibrate with each shaking and movement, reviving the horrible pain. This goes on for 3 hours. Now they must get him to his feet. The executioner and his assistant take hold of the ends of the beam and then hold up the condemned man, who is first sitting, then standing, and then moving him backwards. They place him with his back against the stake previously fixed at Calvary. But this is done by constantly pulling against those two nailed hands. And one thinks of those median nerves. With a great effort, for it is very heavy, and with a skillful gesture, they fix the crossbeam to the stake. The body is meanwhile only held by the nails fixed into the two wrists. Once more, those median nerves. Nails through the palm of his hand would not have been able to bear the weight. Now the rule is that the feet be fixed. They bend the knees and stretch the feet out flat against the wood of the vertical beam. The left foot is flat against the cross. With one blow of the hammer, the nail is driven into the middle of the foot between the second and third metatarsal bones. The assistant then bends the other knee, and the executioner pierces this foot with a second blow in the same place. With a few vigorous blows, the nails are well embedded in the wood. The agony has scarcely begun. The whole work has not taken the two men much more than 2 minutes, and the wounds have not bled yet much. Now a strange phenomenon occurs. The muscles of his arms stiffen of themselves in a contraction that becomes more and more accentuated. His deltoid muscles and his biceps become strained and stand out. His fingers are drawn sharply inwards. It's a cramp. Many of you have experienced this. Progressive pain in the calves of the legs or between the ribs. One must immediately relax the contracted muscle by extending it. But watch, on his thighs and on his legs there are monstrous rigid bulges, and his toes are bent, muscles become tightened in set undulations, then the intercostals, then the muscles of his neck, then the respiratory. His breathing has gradually become shorter and lighter. The air enters with a whistling sound, but scarcely comes out any longer. He is breathing in the upper regions only. He breathes in a little, but cannot breathe out. He thirsts for air. It is like someone in the throes of asthma. A flush has gradually spread over his pale face. It has turned a violent purple and then blue. He is asphyxiating. His lungs, which are loaded with air, can no longer empty themselves. His forehead is covered with sweat. His eyes are bulging and rolling. But an appalling pain must be hammering in his head. He is going to die. But no, his hour has not yet come. Behold, what happens now? Slowly, with a superhuman effort, he is pressing on the nails of his feet to push himself up so he can breathe. That is to say, he is pressing on his wounds. The ankles and knees stretch themselves out bit by bit, and the body is gradually lifted, thus relieving the pressure on his arms. We thus see how through his own efforts, the feeling of being strangled grows less. The muscles of his chest become relaxed. The breathing becomes more ample and moves down to a lower level. The lungs are unloaded and his face regains a little color. Why is he making all this effort? It is in order to speak to us. Father, forgive them. But a moment later, his body begins to sink down once more, and the whole cycle of pain returns again. And each time that he speaks, we have seven of his words preserved. And each time that he wishes to breathe, it will be necessary for him to straighten himself, to get back his breath, holding himself upright on the nails through his feet. And each movement has its echo, so to speak, in his hands, an inexpressible pain caused by the median nerve stretching against the nails. He can only escape from this asphyxiation for a moment at a time and at the cost of terrible suffering and by an effort of his will. This is going to last for 3 hours. Oh, poor Jesus. Forgive a surgeon these words. But I also know that your wounds are becoming infected. A swarm of horrible flies, of great yellow and blue flies that always afflict the dead, is whirling around your body. And they swoop down on the different wounds in order to suck at them and to lay their eggs. They set on your face. And you cannot drive them away. It will soon be 3 o'clock. He cries out, "It is finished." Then drawing himself up once more, and as if to make us understand that he is dying of his own free will, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." He died when he willed to do so. My brothers and sisters, my comments now, not the doctor's. This is hard to hear. It was, of course, much harder to bear. If we do not know what Jesus endured, then we will not know the love that caused him to freely bear this for our redemption. Nor will we know the true cost of the wrong we do. Can you repeat after me? It was not Pilate. No, it was my sins that condemned you to die.
It was not Pilate. No, it was my sins that condemned you to die.
Again, please. It was not the nails that kept you on the cross. It was your love for me. And can we say together, I love you, my beloved Jesus.
I love you more than myself.
I love you more than myself. I repent with my whole heart for having offended you. Never permit me to separate myself from you again. Grant that I may love you always, and then do with me what you will.